You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
So this is Tez Ilias. As you will hear, I've been waiting to get Tez on the show for some time, and it's really exciting now. I've probably mentioned this before. When I get to the stage of this, I realise this show's been going for 6 years. I thought it was five, but it's not, it's six. And now I get to see people do very early work and then see them get better and better and better. And Tez is now someone who is just so exciting to watch. He carries himself, and we'll talk about this, he carries himself on stage like he knows he's going to be massive, which is why it's all the more laudable when he opens up about his flaws and his own unconscious biases as honestly as he is about to. Strap in, this is going to be a really fascinating conversation. And I want to tell you as well, and I'll remind you of this in the middle bit, on May the 7th, he is doing a DVD taping at the iconic South Bank Centre on the Thames. This is the show I saw at Soho Theatre a few weeks or months ago. I just loved it. You can hear in the interview how much I enjoyed this show. You can get your tickets from tezilias.com. That's TEZILYAS.com. And you can find him at Tez Ilias on Twitter. So get yourself along to that DVD taping at South Bank Centre on May the 7th. But now, this is the brilliant Tez. Where should we start? I every time I hear your name, the first vision of you I see is you at the Wardrobe in Bristol, upstairs at the Wardrobe, wearing a suit.
Yes.
Because I remember me and my wife were there watching and we both went, oh, hello, he's going places.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
I remember that gig.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah, it was, what, 2011, 12, 13, something like that.
I read on your Wikipedia page earlier that you started stand-up in 2015, and I thought, no, you
didn't. What? I don't know who writes these Wikipedia pages, no, but
yours is very well done. It's loads of attributed quotes in, like, I thought to myself, I wonder if Tez or someone in Tez's
employee. No, I have no idea who's done it, because Everyone who asks me, I tell them, yeah, I started in 2010, and I've been going full-time since to the end of 2016. But so I don't know whether 2015...
It's when
I did my... I guess it's when I did my debut show and someone's slightly misinterpreted.
Misunderstood how it
works.
Yeah. So, well, tell me about that gig. Who were you at that gig?
I was a guy in my 20s working for the civil service, who'd accidentally stepped into doing stand-up comedy and was just having a lot of fun, and found out quite quickly that he was quite good at it, like decent at it, and then just thought, I'll stop speaking in the third person.
And then you have to in order to say that you're good at something. You're so British. Like, we all are so British. You know, it's very hard to say, I just turned out to have a sort of natural ability to do it without thinking, oh, Christ, this is awful.
But yeah,
I think we can take for granted your confidence in your ability.
Yeah, thank you. I am. It's a pet hit of mine is modest. What's the word I'm looking for?
False modesty.
Yeah, false modesty. Fucking hate it. Oh, I hate it. When someone comes off stage and they're like, oh, yeah, that was great. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry. I was like, no, you were here.
Yeah.
You know
yeah,
how
yeah.
good it was.
Yeah.
So what is this bullshit? So people at school when they were like, oh, I didn't revise.
Yeah.
And then get A star. Like, you fucking revised, man. Just, it doesn't matter. We all revised.
That's, I can't remember who said it to me. I wish I could attribute it. But I often think at this time of year when people are starting like, oh, I've got nothing for Edinburgh. You're like, come on, you've revised.
Hey, Jordan fucking Brooks, man.
Yeah.
Prick. So yeah, I think it's not remiss for me to say that I was quite good quite quickly because in my first year I was in the final of the Leicester Square competition, BBC New Comedy Award. I won the King Gong and a couple of other minor competitions that are not worth.
Which also suggests you'd entered those in your first year, so that belies a certain amount of confidence. Like, you're not hanging around going, okay, how does this work? What do I do? How long do I wait? You're going, enter.
Yeah, straight away. I was doing it. I remember. So I did a comedy course that I came across accidentally. I was Googling writing workshops because I just moved to London and had a few friends, but, you know, everyone's scattered all over the place. It's a big, lonely place. So I was looking for writing workshops and I came across a stand-up workshop. To say that I never considered it would be a lie. I'd considered it in my fantasies, maybe, when I was young, in the same way that one might consider being an astronaut. Because where I come from, no one works in the arts. It's just not a career path.
Which is Blackburn.
Yes.
Blackburn, actually.
Yeah. And it's just not a career path. I don't know anyone in the arts other than myself, for people who I grew up with. And I just thought to myself, well, I'll go on this thing. Worst case scenario, I'd meet new people and make a fool of myself. Both of those things I can live with. And I went on this thing, it was one day a week for 6 weeks, run by Rob Hitchmoff.
Okay.
I don't think he does much stand-up anymore, but I think he used to, and I found it an incredibly useful course. I just did a showcase, people left in the right places, and then just found the burgeoning open mic circuit, which even then seemed to be full at capacity back in 2010. And just found that I had a bit of a knack for it, and I wrote so much in those first few months, so much. Like, I was just never rested on my laurels. Almost at every gig I was trying stuff out, and then I found a 5-7 minutes that I then honed for competitions.
That's interesting.
And I was lucky to find that quickly.
I think probably my competition 7 was everything I had of any value. Do you know what I mean?
This is all I've got.
It sounds more like you were writing so hard, you were able to select the best bits.
So much. On my first ever gig, the showcase, I think we were all given 5-7 minutes or whatever. I did 20 minutes. Because I'd written so much. Like yesterday, my gig was, the show you came to was meant to be 60 minutes. It was 72 minutes.
Yes.
I have no concept
financial
of
penalty coming your way for this.
I have no concept of time.
Yeah.
On stage. I remember. Just 5 minutes, just going a blink of an eye. I think part of the reason was because part of the reason I've never won a competition is because my 5 was always an 8.
Yeah.
So they would never let me win, which is fine in hindsight.
I mean,
by the time I always felt very hard done by. But going, yeah, I was doing 8-9 minutes.
There's no false modesty there. I think the reason I didn't win is I did too long. You are, I mean, it's interesting that your perception of time on stage, I think that's definitely true of a lot of comics, certainly early doors, it just disappears. The time disappears. You can't believe you've been on stage for as long as you have. But also, I think you have a quality that you are so watchable. Like, it was, you know, whatever it was, a 70-something minute show last night. No one in that room needed it to end particularly. But I'm interested in what it feels like to you in terms of like your energy level doing the show. Because if I say you kind of cruise through it, I don't mean that your foot isn't on the gas. Mm. I just mean that the writing is there. It's so lean. The character is there. It's so precise. You know, the character persona.
Mm.
It looks like you're just, it looks like it's a walk in the park. Do you know what I mean? It looks like it's easy, not in the sense of lazy. Do you know what I mean?
I've no one's ever approached me like that, but I quite like that description because I don't get nervous anymore. like I'm so serene, and like, there might be a bit like maybe like 5 minutes before I'm going on, just a little like a little butterfly or something, but I'm so calm on, I'm so relaxed. I think because this last Edinburgh didn't go as well for me as I intended it to. I intended this show to be my breakout show, and the show wasn't as good as it, you saw it yesterday. It wasn't quite as good as that as it was in Edinburgh, so I've tweaked it slightly. And it didn't just quite happen for me this Edinburgh. And the whole thing just calmed me down. And I'm just so much... I've seen the difference between just last August and what are we in March. What is it, 7-8 months? I'm such a better, more relaxed performer. And I'm just enjoying myself so much on stage. And I'm just, like, yeah, I'm just calm. And I'm not... If I know what I'm doing and what I'm saying, I know my character enough to just enjoy it.
Talk to me about the content of the show for people that haven't heard you, people listening in other countries or...
Yeah. You know. So the show's called Testify. And originally it was about me testifying against the assumptions that people have of me. And the labels that I wear, Asian, working class, Northern, left wing, and Muslim. And the show kind of, that was the idea of the show, to explore all of those things over an hour. And then the kind of show slightly morphed into something else. So I'd still touch on those things, but kind of slowly, then the most interesting, and what I realised after Edinburgh was that the most interesting bit was the McDonald's story.
Yes.
With my niece and nephew.
Yes.
Whereas in Edinburgh, that all came right at the end.
Okay. That structure is... I can see why it's a better show for that change in structure.
Yeah.
Because it's an anecdote you could tell in 90 seconds.
Mm.
But it's a really... It's just the backbone of the show, isn't it? God, how annoying.
Yeah, so annoying. And like when I was in Edinburgh, I was kind of like... Because the previews went better than my previous two shows.
Yeah.
But Edinburgh didn't go well as my previous... Not that it was bad, just not as good.
And I suppose you are at the stage now where you need a breakout show because all of the stars are in alignment. Mm. It's really interesting. Is this number three or four?
Three, yeah, three.
It's really interesting because you're... Again, something you're really good at is promising big. And I don't mean that you then don't achieve it, but the way you hold yourself on stage is like you're already a success. The way you talk to us is like you're already famous. You know, it's like that whole thing about calling your fans Tesbians.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
You've, like, that's, it's a joke. It's also genuine branding. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, you know, it's, you've got the hashtag, you've got the Twitter ID, non-intrusively. Do you know what I mean? Like, you are a businessman. Like, when I first saw you in that gig, you're wearing a suit. And I know you've said, I read a previous interview where you said that you were just coming from work.
So yeah, a lot of time,
suit,
yeah.
But you also decided not to change out of your suit. Yeah. So it was a decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you...
And you know why I changed out of the suit?
Go on.
Because of the alopecia.
Right, really?
Yeah. Because you sort of kind of lost my hair to it. And I was sort of insecure about it, which I talked about yesterday. So I wanted to wear these caps and didn't go with the suit. So I took the suit off.
Oh, so that you could wear a cap?
Mm. So I thought, I can't wear Trilby.
I think that's probably the right decision.
Yeah. And then I thought, actually, I quite like my look without the suit on, the more casual kind of look that I have now, which you saw yesterday. I really like that.
Tell me if this is inherently offensive, an assumption or an observation, but I thought, is that post... I know you work with Guz Khan.
Yeah.
And is that post... A little bit, I'm representing.
A little bit. Also, I moved back home and I thought, if I'd never gone to university and ended up in this middle class civil service life, how would I have dressed?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been in a suit.
Okay, good. We'll maybe come back to that. But the point I'm making about the way you carry yourself, does that resonate for you?
Yeah.
You behave as if this is a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I've always been confident, and I think success begets success, and if you carry yourself in a certain way, people will look at you in a certain way. I do believe that. And I think I've always... That confidence of speaking in front of people, I've always had. Is speaking in front of people was never the... So when I started doing stand-up, or when on the course, that idea of doing stand-up wasn't scary. The idea of standing in front of people and saying stuff wasn't scary. Obviously... I didn't have any material, so that was all new. But I've never been shy speaking in front of people.
And do you recognise that is different to the way a lot of stand-ups approach it?
Yes.
And what is that difference about?
I don't obnoxiousness. I don't know because I didn't go to drama school, so I don't know where it's come from. But I've always had it. I always shouted out in assembly, like heckled the teacher in assembly, not in a horrible way, but just like shouted out the end, like shouted out answers to rhetorical questions in assembly in front of like the whole school. Like I was always a pain in the ass. But I don't know where it's come from.
And it's all, but it's not simply about confidence. Because I don't want listeners to this to just go, okay, he's confident. There's something in addition to that, which is to do with your, like the way you bring yourself to comedy isn't as someone who doesn't seem to me to be a typical kind of, there's a thing that exists, I need to find my place within it. It feels like you've got time and inclination and you want to do a thing. And yeah, comedy might be it. Do you know what I mean? That's not quite what I mean.
Yeah, go on.
It's more that this is simply an option for you because you're... That sounds wrong as well. I'll keep deleting these until I get to the right bit. What do you think?
I'll say that I have never been as good at anything as I am at stand-up.
Okay.
Like, there's nothing else that I'm good at. Like, I was all right in my day job. I got by. But towards the end, I was terrible because I was spending all my time thinking that I'm doing stand-up. Love sport, not good at a single sport. I'm not particularly a great writer when it comes to like writing prose or stuff like that. This is the one thing that I'm...
I think what I'm trying to say is it's about ownership. I think I, and a bunch of comics say, I'll just talk about myself. I think I approached stand-up in the early days like there is this thing and I need to try and belong. Whereas I think you hold yourself with an internal belonging.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Doesn't that sound much better than the accidentally imprinted that I was trying to... It's almost also, like you don't really care to...
Also, I feel like a lot of my peers treat comedy as an academic exercise. Okay. And I am not a student of the game. I don't watch that much stand-up. Before I came to stand-up, I'd never been to a comedy club. I'd been to see Jimmy Carr live. I'd been to see Chris Rock live. And I think I'd seen the Comedy Store Players. So I'd been to the Comedy Store to watch the Comedy Store Players. But I'd never seen a mixed bill of stand-up at a club, ever. And so all of that was new to me. I had no idea how the circuit worked, nothing. I had no friends in it. And even now, I don't watch... when people talk about all the Netflix specials, I don't watch that much. Like, I'm raving about Maria Bamford this week. I only know her because everyone raves about her, but I've not seen a single routine she's ever done. I'd like to, but I just don't watch that much stand-up. But I love it. I love it, but I just don't... I don't know what it is.
Do you feel good about that? Because I always feel like I don't watch as much as I should, but that's accompanied with a kind of craven. Oh, God, I must watch the new Chris Rock special that everyone's talking about.
I did watch that.
Yeah, I do like it, and I will get round to it. Yeah. I don't know when people sit down and watch stuff.
Yeah, no, I don't know, because people watch... Because some people watch everything, and they listen to every podcast that seems out there and stuff, and I'm like, I don't know if it's because I don't have the time. God, I probably do have the time, because I procrastinate a lot, but I don't know. I just don't know.
So, and what does that mean in terms of your... that sense of internal belonging?
I think it makes me a little bit smug. I think a little bit, because I'm like, because I think to myself, like, my heroes, be it Peter Kay or Dave Chappelle or Russell Peters, didn't grow up treating comedy in the way I think a lot of my peers treat comedy now.
Sure.
They did, I mean, I'm sure they watched comedy, but they did it. And then they got really good at it and they carried on doing it. And that's what I'm trying to do, more of that. So when my heroes, like Chappelle or Peter Kay, release a special, I will 100% watch that, because they're my comedy heroes, the ones I grew up with, the ones that inspired to be a comedian and the comedian that I am and want to be. But I don't have an inclination to watch every single piece of stand-up that's ever existed or listen to every bit of somebody talking about comedy. Which I think that's a little bit different to some of my peers who are interacting on Facebook and who seem to just digest every single bit, who maybe they think that by osmosis it would make them better. But I think doing it makes you better.
In terms of your what inspiration you draw, you clearly draw a lot of inspiration from your heroes.
What technical things do you think you've improved upon in the light of...
I think maybe a year or two in, I started going a little bit deadpan. And I think that was more of a, it was a defence mechanism because, you know, you have those bad gigs and so you stop wanting to put yourself out there. Because I feel like the more of a big character you're on stage and then you die, the more of an idiot you feel. At least that's yeah, how I feel.
If you put everything on the line, yeah, yeah, then everything can get killed.
If you go out like proper jazz hands and then the audience just don't want it, you feel like a dick.
Show title for next year. Yeah. Proper jazz hands.
yeah, you feel like an absolute dickhead. And kind of like, and I think I'd been in the middle of like having this, like a run of like tough gigs. And as I just went increasingly more deadpan to the kind of like distance myself from what I was saying. So like, if they don't laugh, obviously I don't care. And then I think I kind of ended up just doing that for about 6-7 months. And then I transitioned from doing, I call it the nice Sunday to Thursday circuit, to getting the open spots on the club circuit Friday, mm-hmm. Saturday nights. And it didn't work.
Why not?
It didn't work because I wasn't selling my material in the way that it needed to be sold in front of those audiences, mm-hmm. who are there to be entertained. And I learned, and initially I thought my material wasn't good enough or my material was too clever or whatever I thought it was. But it wasn't that. I just needed to sell it in the right way. So I eventually learned to say the same thing, just in a different way. And one of the, my training ground for that was Up the Creek, really, who managed me. And Up the Creek is one of the oldest comedy clubs in Greenwich. And is just doing that often enough taught me how to deliver the same material, but to this really rowdy, drunk Essex Kent crowd. And then eventually I learned to play and eventually they really enjoyed what I was doing. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay, you need to be more yourself because you're not deadpan in real life.
And something I remember you saying was, we talked specifically a little while ago about, probably 8 years ago now, every time I say a little while, I just get horrified by the speed.
I'm trying to think of all the places we've gigged at.
I think we were talking about Chris Rock and we were talking about clapping.
Kevin Hart. He's so, in terms of inspiration, like I watch, a lot of, when I do watch stand-up, a lot of it, I'm not watching the material so much, I'm watching the stagecraft. And I've seen that Kevin Hart, who's one of the most, animated voices in stand-up, his first special, he doesn't take the mic out of the stand. Which, I remember watching it thinking, that's, for someone who's so animated, it seems a really bizarre choice to have made. But it's interesting. I think it's a really, really good special. But he does this thing where, when he's selling a punchline, he does this thing where he goes, "And the thing that I'm saying is this." And I found that fascinating, the emphasis that he was putting by clapping. And I don't know if you saw it, I do it a little bit I think I've appropriated that a little bit, I think.
I think we were having that conversation because I was talking to you about the use of your radio mic, which is like a little Tez thing.
Now. Yes. My Britney mic.
Yeah, the Britney mic, which means that you can clap.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think I've conflated that with Chris Rock delivering the feed line twice. That technical trick. Which maybe that is something you don't do as much, I don't think. But that is a really interesting, for someone that doesn't watch other stand-up, that is a really interesting and specific piece of stagecraft to have picked up on. I remember someone saying to me, "Oh, do you record your gigs?" And I was like, "Yeah, I record most of them and I listen back to most of them, I make the effort." And they said, "Yeah, but do you video them?" And I was like, "No, I don't do that." Because that is like watching your physicality on stage is really important. And that's a really interesting, I just think that's a really interesting lens through which to look at Kevin Hart is to go, "Take the mic out of the stand, mate." Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because you're grounding, you're clipping your own wings.
Because the whole hour, that was his first hour. And he was already famous because he came out to a standing ovation. You know, like a lot of American comics do when before they start a show, they come out. Black comics especially, I think. You're already famous, so it's not like this is not a typical debut newcomer kind of show.
Was he already famous, or is that just clever framing whereby they've kind of instigated a standing ovation as you walk out on your first thing because to make people go, well, he's obviously already famous because of the standing ovation. I think so much of it is we're talking about how you frame and how your first DVD. If I were you, I'd engineer a standing ovation.
100%. I'm taping the show in May at the South Bank.
Are you? Great.
Yes.
Great.
I'm looking forward to that.
Well, now when we watch it, we'll know.
Yeah.
I'll put this on the extra content.
But in this case, it actually was a standing ovation. No, mate. Come on. I've seen the show.
Let's get back to the show. And I'm really interested to hear this thing about wanting a breakout year. Because that to me, says a lot about your ambition. And it says a lot about your honesty to be able, your humility to be able to look at it and go, that wasn't the success that I wanted to. For a show that is, I mean, undoubtedly it was excellent. Last night, I hadn't said this as much at the beginning of the interview as I normally do. I loved it. And that's I thought you were getting big rounds of applause and big jokes. That opening set, the Punisher Muslim section at the beginning, I was like, you're opening with this. That is a dick swinging move to go, just have this enormous set piece. Do you know what I mean?
Like, and that's
you
new. Didn't close that, on that. That only came this month as well.
Holy shit, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that happened this month.
What I really liked about your show was that you genuinely talked about the stuff that you promised to talk about. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible as a comic to have a relationship with an audience where, and I think we'd probably name the same people if we talked about this, where you promise a certain amount of incisive political debate and you don't necessarily deliver on that.
Mm.
There are a few people who I think, oh, that's interesting. Their brand is that they're that guy or that lady. And actually, I'm not seeing that. You absolutely delivered for you. And I suppose it was in my mind because the poster, there's two images I've seen for Testify, and one of them is in the nice orange collarless shirt that, you know, nonetheless connotes Guantanamo.
Yeah.
In a way that I was like, well, that's interesting. Like, you've kind of gone hard on the imagery there. Let's see if the content matches up to it. And it 100% did. And it was funny throughout. I thought it was an excellent show. So going into Edinburgh, have you got a kind of a career strategy in mind, thinking this year has to be this so that XYZ can happen?
Yeah, every year I go in, and I shouldn't think like this, and I keep getting told off by my management and people that I work with, but it's just there, going to get nominated. Just a year.
Thanks for talking so candidly about that. Everyone pretends they don't care.
It's bullshit, man. Of course, man. And I say now I don't care, because I mean, you can talk about that if you want, but there is, that is every year, and particularly the last 2 years, I haven't been as much. I mean, last year I wasn't as, because I didn't feel like my show deserved it. That at least I think this is the show it should have been in Edinburgh, what you saw yesterday. But it wasn't quite. It was 90% there, but it wasn't quite there. So not getting the nod this year was, I was like, fine. This show didn't deserve it. Just what I brought this month. Year before, the show that you saw, I thought, maybe could have tipped, maybe perhaps Tez Talks is the one I was gutted about, because that was my debut show. That was the one, the best newcomer one. That was I still find it hard to hide my bitterness about how I feel about that, because
who got nominated that year?
Let's Sophie won.
Let's imagine for a minute it isn't etched on your soul.
Yeah, so let me just think about this, because it's been ages and it's not just there at the top of my head. Stu's really edited this to make it sound like I just said it at the top of my head. Sophie Hagen won, Larry Dean, who I love, Daphne, Phil Wang's sketch group.
Yeah. Co-owned by the other two members.
Yes. Story Beast or Midnight Beast? Something Beast.
Was it the Story Beast? Was it John Henry Fowle?
Yes.
He's like storytelling.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. If it wasn't, I'm sorry. But it was Something Beast. One of the Puppies lads, Tom Parry.
Yep.
You know, who's only been going 15 years. And had a BBC sitcom. Who else got nominated?
Mate, Mickey Flanagan got nominated for the Perrier after a 25-year career.
Yeah. But it hadn't already been nominated 3 times. For best show. And there are a couple of other... I can't remember off the top of my head now. But, you know, I'm sure all those people deserved it. But it was hard. Because also, I talked a little bit about in the show last night about where I've come from and kind of like this proper working class upbringing. I had no role models whose footsteps I'm following in. No one that I know is in this business. I kind of like accidentally find myself in this thing talking about things that I'm really, really passionate about, and I feel like I feel like people of colour in Edinburgh don't get their due when they talk about things that are important to them. And I genuinely believe that. Because I look at some of the shows I've been nominated over recent years, and I think to myself, all of these issues are really important, but it's white people talking about issues that are important to them that other white people are responding to and empathising with and saying are really important. And when I went up with test talks, it was... I mean, Islamophobia has been topical for a better part of a decade now. It's not a new... It's not been topical this year. And I was talking about it in what I thought was quite a unique way, because it was a mock conversion class, so everyone who came in and the review was, the show was ridiculously well reviewed. Like, I couldn't have asked for a better, in terms of all of that, I couldn't have asked for a better Fringe. If anything, I might have toned it down, because I would have thought it's a slight exaggeration. It was so good, and then I just didn't get that, just that cherry on top didn't come at the end. And I just felt like I deserved it. But it didn't happen. And then each year I've put less emphasis on it. To the point that I'm now going, well, I look at the shows that have been nominated and I've won over the recent years, and they've been great. And I've seen Hannah's show, which is great, and I saw Richard's show, which is great. But like, I can't do this self-flagellation that they've done in their shows to win an award. I won't do it. I can't do it. So if that's what they want now, then fine. That's not, it's not something that I'm going to aspire to.
Okay. What sorts of things? Thank you. You took the words out of my mouth. What sorts of things do your management say to you when they are trying to, or your friends say to you when they're trying to disavow you of that kind of sentiment?
Of which particular
specifically bit? Your focus on the awards and your feeling that you should...
Yeah, I mean, they're very, very good at keeping me grounded in that you're not entitled to anything, which is true. And that also the success that I've had, which is particularly on the back of my debut show, has been so, so good. Like, because what you go to Edinburgh for, if you're in it to break through, is work afterwards, particularly TV and radio work, which I've had in abundance since 2015. So that's what should be my focus, not this thing
that people want to win in order to get the stuff that you've got anyway.
Or get nominated.
Yeah.
Because for me, winning wasn't the thing. Being nominated was the thing. Being in the conversation would have been the thing. But I had all of that without it. But I think the reason why I still hung on to it at the back of my head is because of, I do genuinely have a sense of injustice towards acts of colour. And this isn't only about me. It's about wider than me. Because I looked back at the judges. I think they have 10 judges every year on the panel. And as I started looking, and then I got intrigued and I looked all the way back to when it first started, because they're all on the website. And honestly, before last year, there was one last year, but before last year, I couldn't recognise a single person of colour on the judging panel of the award for 35 years, however long it's been going, which I think is astonishing. And it's an oversight that no one, to my knowledge, has ever brought up.
Yeah,
because they talk about Oscars so wide and stuff,
absolutely.
And people bring that up, and rightly so. And people in this country are really like, "Oh yeah, we that's wrong, and something should be done to address that." And it seems to me there's a blind spot in this country towards racism.
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah,
and that is one of them. And I thought, why is no? And I've wanted to bring it up for a couple of years now, but I've always got. I also don't want to burn my bridges with it.
Sure,
but I've got to the point where now I don't care.
Yeah. And I suppose
I'm post it now.
One of the first thing, I mean, absolutely, I am surprised and dismayed to agree with you. I'm surprised and dismayed I hadn't noticed that. But I think part of why I hadn't noticed that is that I try to maintain a healthy distance from imagining that they mean anything. Not just awards meaning anything, but specifically the inverted commas Edinburgh Comedy Award, which is no more official. because it is not a government body. Mm. It is not
It's one person going, I'm running this thing, and it's a private enterprise.
That is exactly the phrase for it. It's a private enterprise. But, and that's not to denigrate it, even private enterprises should have oversight. And although I try to stay out of it to the extent that I can never tell you who the nominees are. I know some comics are kind of like almost like football pundits. That was O'Doherty's 2007 show. Do you know what I mean?
They're a bit Rain Man about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, lots of people are. And I'm absolutely not. I couldn't even tell you whether or not you got nominated. You'll be pleased or dismayed to know. I do think that is a really good point that needs addressed, that...
And I just want to be clear, like, I wasn't entitled to the award. I wasn't entitled to be nominated. But I do, from criticising myself, I do have a slight chip on my shoulder, but it just based on my background and what I had to go through to get there.
Okay, let's talk about this in depth then. So I agree with you that you're kind of like a quintuple threat. You're kind of non-white, working class, Muslim, all of those things you've suggested. Plus, you were doing material that is provocative, that is intelligent, that's well researched, very funny, as you said,
and well reviewed.
Well reviewed.
So subjectively,
absolutely. At the same time, of course, you're right. You're not entitled to it,
and I understand.
And
that.
You are in danger, I suspect, of sounding to a critic that you are. That you seem entitled to it, because no one's entitled to it. And every time we go up and every time there are nominations and awards of any sort in any kind of media, all you need to do is remind yourself of the other shows that were nominable, whatever the word is, eligible, and the other brilliant shows you've seen that were eligible that weren't. And the way I deal with it myself, and of course we all want a big pat on the back, and of course it would open doors industrially. But I always think to myself, oh, am I saying I'm better than John Luke Roberts? Because I'm not better than John Luke Roberts. Do you know what I mean? So that particular show, his show about his dad, was one of the best things I've ever seen. Didn't get a sniff. So I suppose there are lots of different... You were about to say something.
I was going to say that there's a lot of shows that I've seen over years that haven't been nominated that I think have been overlooked. And there's a middle-class white acts. So, you know, it's not as simple as...
Sure.
Oh, these bloody racists! It's not as black and white as that.
I think it's fair to say that on the other side of the coin, there will be lots of middle class white acts going, holy shit! Like, from the point of view of a middle class white act, there are simply so many of us that it's impossible for us to get a look in. That must sound ridiculous to someone on the other side of that face.
Yeah,
going,
of course.
No, all you guys do is win. Yeah, not me. So it is. At the same time, I'm not saying that's the same as being in a situation where you go, I have recognised an unspoken endemic preference amongst the judges. Mm. Do you think, what's the solution? What's the solution?
I mean, the solution is to have a more racially diverse judging panel. But then you look backwards and you think, where does that judging panel derive from? And it derives from TV, radio, print, and then some competition winners. I'm not sure about the selection of those. And then in those areas, there's a dearth in representation, racial representation. And so it's a problem that needs fixing up from the bottom. So it's not their fault necessarily that they haven't been that diverse, because the pool that they pick from hasn't been that diverse. So it's a bigger problem than the awards.
I'm just being quiet to see if you'd say anything else about it. I absolutely agree.
No, that's not to say that white judges can't look at a person of colour show and think, oh my God, that really speaks to me and stuff. I just think didn't seem to have done over the last decade. Because I look at some of the shows that have been nominated, some of the really personable shows talking about issues that affect people, such as feminism, mental health, gay rights, or all these things. And I think these are really, really important issues. But so are some of the things that people of colour are talking about. Their shows are really, really funny, why aren't they being reviewed in the same way?
Are there particular shows besides your own that are by non-white comics that you think, like, were there years where you were individually outraged going, why did this not get seen? Why did this not get
seen? I mean, it doesn't... me saying this now is almost going to be ridiculously ridiculous, and it obviously does not matter at all, but Trevor Noah not getting nominated in 2011 was fucking insane. Particularly what his short, what his debut show was about. I think a couple of Dane's last shows were very, very unfortunate to have not been nominated, given his how funny he is and some of the stuff he was talking about. And there are one or two things that are just off the top of my head. Oh, it also doesn't matter now, but I remember in 2013, the best show that I saw in 2013 was Nish Kumar's show, which was Ruminations on the subject of...
On the nature of subjectivity.
Nature of subjectivity, which I thought it was just phenomenal. And it didn't get nominated. And I suspect one of the reasons was because Ramesh got nominated. And it was that thing where you can't, you know, you can't have two women, you can't, but you've got Ramesh, so... Obviously, it was Ramesh or Nish. It was Bridget or someone else. It was Josie or someone else. You know, it was, yeah, it was like, it was Ramesh or Nish. It couldn't have been Ramesh and Nish. And I love Ramesh. Ramesh's show was great. But Nish's show was amazing. And I remember that was, I think that was the first time it occurred to me. That was the first, it was 2013, that I went, why wasn't it and Nish? Why wasn't Nish nominated as well? And maybe that's not what... I'm sure that's not what happened. They did not sit there going, right, we've nominated Ramesh, so no other acts of colour need to be considered. That's not what happened.
But you could see... I know that. You could see how decisions people aren't even aware that they're making.
Yeah, there's a subconscious bias.
Yeah, yeah.
Or an unconscious... Sorry, unconscious bias is the term. That happened. And these aren't done malicious. These aren't malicious choices. People shouldn't be dragged about this, but it's just something that needs to be addressed. And unconscious bias is a thing that needs to be addressed because you're unconscious about it. I have unconscious biases.
So this is Tez. Now, I'm going to mention straight at the top, there is 20 minutes of extra content from this episode available to members. What's a member? I'll explain in the postamble. But we're going to go into Tez exploring why his childhood friends don't go to his shows, what it's like to be, his term, Asian famous, and how he acknowledges his own unconscious bias. There's some really interesting stuff in here. We are going to get into some fascinating stuff any minute now. A bit of background for those people that don't know. At the Edinburgh Festival, which is the largest open access arts festival in the world and consequently the largest comedy festival in the world, there are numerous awards for comedy and comedians, and some of the best known are, well, they were formerly named after their sponsors, but they're currently called the Edinburgh Comedy Awards. And they are extraordinarily important to some comedians, to some of the comedy industry. You know the official policy of this show on awards, but I'm just letting you know that bit of background because we're going to talk about something that I think is pretty important. That's all coming up in a moment. Now, just to remind you, Tez's DVD taping is on May the 7th at the South Bank Centre on the Thames. And I've seen that show. It is called Testify, and it is genuinely brilliant. And to hear from him at the beginning of this interview, that section that he did about that awful leaflet that got posted through lots of people's doors in Muslim communities in the UK, and then to find out that was recent, and he opened with this amazing powerhouse bit about it, he's just absolutely going places. So do yourself a favour, and then you can say you were there at his first DVD record. We'll go back into the show in just a moment. I'll explain what a member is, as I said, in the postamble. For now, though, my own tour is available. All the information is available from comedianscomedian.com/tour. And I am going to a bunch of places. The next ones coming up are the South Street Arts Centre in Reading. Then I'm at the Corsham Pound Arts Centre. And then the Hen and Chickens in Bristol, which is fantastic. The Rondo in Bath, Epic Studios in Norwich, Royal and Durngate in Northampton, Warwick Arts Centre, not in Warwick, Henry Tudor House in Shrewsbury, Swindon Arts Centre, Farnham Maltings, and the West End Centre in Aldershot. And then even more places in June. And nope, none in July. Then just a bunch of places in June. So get along to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out where I'm going to be near you and when. And come along and see me. A couple of things to chat about afterwards. But for now, thank you for all your donations so far. Those of you in particular who have recently set up recurring donations or have been doing that either through Patreon, Moonclerk or PayPal for some time, things are about to get interesting. So if you would like to join them, go to comedianscomedian.com/donate and you can find out exactly how interesting things are going to get. So thanks for sharing the show and supporting it as you have been. You can email me any questions or suggestions for guests, info@comedianscomedian.com. And I am starting to think about what I'm going to do in Edinburgh this year. It's going to be a big Edinburgh for me this year, my 25th year. I'm doing a 250-seater at 2:50 in the afternoon. And two of those things are coincidental. But I'm expecting to have a big, big year with wife and toddler in tow as well. Not in tow, doing their own thing. I'll be in tow of them. But what I'm saying is I am going to have to be really clever with my time this year to try and get a bunch of shows together, a bunch of episodes in the can, whilst not having all that much free time. I've got a big room to fill, so I'm going to be doing lots of extra spots. If you're someone that books those in Edinburgh and pays, get in touch. But what I need is a load of pre-work for the Edinburgh Festival so that I can make sure I nail down, what, 10, 12 shows, go and see them, pod them up, get them in the can, because I need to earn myself some money in order to get some paternity leave. Anyway, okay, back to Tez, and I'll speak to you after this bit.
Talk to me about the chickens bit.
Okay. So that came from a real life situation about 3 or 4 years ago, where I was sat in Nando's and I was eating I think I had a half a chicken, and I was just looking around the restaurant, and it's a chicken restaurant, and there's so many chickens on everyone's meals, and I just thought to myself, and then I think we had a wings platter. There were a platter of wings as well on the table that I was sharing with my friends. I think there might have been 12 wings. I was like, oh God, that's 6 birds. And I've got this half a chicken here, and this is another bird, and that's counting me up. And I was thinking, this is a lot of chickens that are just being eaten in this snapshot that I can see right now. And then I extrapolated a bit like I did in the show.
Sure.
And
I went,
okay, so how many chickens would that be in a day then? And I kind of had to figure out there. I go, maybe 500. And then I went, well, that's one Nando's, and that's open 350 days of the year, so that's, I think I got my calculator right, that's that many. That's just one Nando's though. And then you multiply that by all the Nando's, and then that's, you're on hundreds of thousands of chickens, and you're going, fuck. No, you're on millions by then, just Nando's. And then you're going, oh shit, there's KFC, there's all those chicken shops that you see on every corner, there's all the restaurants that sell chicken, there's all the takeaways takeaways and all the supermarkets that sell chicken that you cook at home, and that's just one country. And then there's 195 countries in the world. And then eggs. And I thought, fuck them, the chickens that we're not eating because they're laying eggs. And eggs are in everything. And then I ended up extrapolating it, and I thought, and then I got into the billions, and I went, that can't be right. Because there's ridiculous. I've missed something here. And then I Googled it. And there are, at any one time, there are about 20 billion chickens in the world. And we slaughter about 60 billion a year. It's fucking, it's mad.
I really, as a bit, what I loved about it was it let the sort of goofy part of your personality,
yes,
come out.
Yes.
After some pretty heavy stuff about bombs and nukes.
Yeah.
You know, it really showed a different, pardon the expression, flavour of what you do. And throughout it, I was kind of confident. Well, no, I don't know if I was. I was thinking, is this just a kind of 5-minute goofy bit about chickens? By the end, there's that kind of sting about where do we keep them?
Mm.
And then by the end of the show, I was enjoying, not to give anything away, but I was enjoying an element of the end of the show whereby I was like, well, I bet this is going to come back. And then clearly that's part of the writing, is allowing the clever kids in the audience to pat themselves on the back naturally. So let's talk about the decision. Let's talk about some of the editing decisions of the show. What kind of stuff did you write for this show and then discard?
So there's a 10-minute chunk that was in the Edinburgh show that I cut from this show because it made it too flabby. And in Edinburgh, there was always kind of a lull in the show, and it's usually on that bit. So I spoke at the beginning about, in this show, I wanted to talk about being Muslim, Asian, left-wing, working class and Northern. And the left-wing bit, so the political element of it, got most of that got stripped out of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was me talking about Brexit, it was me talking about left-wing liberals and inherent hypocrisy, when we tap everything on an iPhone, which has been made by iSlaves. And then talking about, and then I had another bit that talked about science and how I hate the term. Someone genuinely said to me once, I thought, I don't believe in religion, I believe in science. When science is a unit of measurement, it's not a belief system. And so I had this bit about that. And just those bits didn't, I liked them individually, they just didn't quite work in the show. And they made the show a little bit too flabby.
Why did they not work in the show?
I'm not sure. I think it got to the... I think part of it was because we talked about the structure and how the McDonald's story works as a bit that I keep coming mm-hmm. in and out of. In Edinburgh, that bit came right at the end. And so I promised this... There's this VT at the top talking about Islamophobia and stuff, and I'd promised this stuff and I hadn't talked about it. So constantly, people are having to watch that, and then we're 40 minutes in, 45 minutes in, and I still haven't brought up what I promised to bring up, which is the sure. thing you're talking about.
Sure.
And then I'm talking about, and then I'm really like lashing liberals, who is the majority of the audience.
Yes.
For their hypocrisy. And identifying as one as well. So it's always we.
Yeah.
But it's not, looking back, it's not. Like, I saw Finn do it really nicely in his show, Finn Taylor.
Yes.
Do it really, really well in his show. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's slightly better way to have done it than what I did.
Is it the limitations of your persona, do you think?
Possibly.
Like, it's you'd be castigating us, and I don't know if your voice... I don't know if I want to be castigated by you. Do you know what I mean? Given your warmth and that kind of...
maybe.
The position you
it
take.
It was a gear change.
Yes.
In my persona rather than in material.
Yes.
And I think that didn't quite work. And then the Brexit bit I really liked, but I had one guy walk out on it in one of the shows, and it got described by a viewer as unnecessarily cruel. But I still really like it. I do.
What was the bit?
So the bit is, I talk about how I...
And the bit, presumably, sorry, just to interrupt, is consigned to history now, because...
No, I mean, I still do it sometimes.
Okay,
So I might do it. So when I go on tour, I come out in the first half, support act break, second half. So I might do it in the first half, maybe. Okay. But the bit is, so I do this bit where I take the piss out of right wingers, and then I say, I don't think, actually, it's not that helpful, actually. I don't think for the discourse it's helpful to treat people like that or to suggest that they're all stupid, because... I was having a conversation with a guy that I overheard that I didn't know a couple of years ago during the time of the referendum say he was voting to leave only because he hated immigration. I know people who vote to leave by their own reasons, but that was his reason. And I got into it with him, and I look back now and I think I did nothing to help the cause. I was arrogant, I was patronising. If anything, I probably reinforced his views to vote the way he wanted to vote. I don't know the guy, I don't know what he's been through, I don't know what life journey he's been on to make him vote the way he wants to vote. And I took no time to try and understand that. Maybe, looking back, maybe that guy just needed a different perspective. Because God forbid, but imagine this guy got cancer. God forbid, but it could happen. And ironically, the doctor that treats him, the doctor that refers him to hospital is Indian. The receptionist that books his appointment is Australian. His medical oncologist is French. His radiographer is Nigerian. The nurses that look after him in hospital are a mixture of Filipino, Polish, British women. The pharmacist that dispenses the medication is a young British Muslim girl with a hijab. And maybe after going on this journey through our NHS, maybe his cold, cold heart will begin to melt as he realises the benefits of immigration, the benefits of a multicultural society. And I just wish, genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, I just really, really wish that on the day of his operation, that his Romanian surgeon gets deported. And then after the laugh, I say, and then he dies. Guys, he dies because you get what you vote for. And I really like it. It works. But
you got a walkout.
Yeah, I had a walkout.
A loud walkout? A fuck you walkout?
No, just a quiet. And you know what? I respected it. It was a dignified sort of, not for me, And he didn't say it, but that's obviously clearly what it was implied. And he just walked out. And he was also sat at the end of a row, which was convenient. So he wasn't shuffling past people for 30 seconds.
I might not like this. Yeah, I'll sit here. Well, does that suggest, or does that opens a window to talk about whether or not you're preaching to the converted?
Yeah, I am conscious about that. But what I will say is preaching to the not converted is hard. Last year, my debut tour.
Yeah, even preachers preach to the converted.
Yeah, exactly. That is, yeah. They don't, yeah. Otherwise, you're a nutter in Hyde Park, in Speaker's Corner. Last year on my debut tour, I was going around all over the place. I was in Borden. Apologies to anyone from Borden, but I don't need to be going to Borden.
I don't think I've ever heard of Borden.
It's near Portsmouth. Blessed soul. And I was going to Maidenhead and all these places and I was having quite. And you saw the show in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. It's quite a fun last year's show. Sorry, it was quite a fun show. And I was just having these really tough gigs. And I just thought to myself this year, I thought, yeah, I shouldn't only play to the converted, but at the same time, I'm like, it's hard. I'm first and foremost, I'm a performer. I'm a comedian. I want to have a good time on stage. I want to feel good about my job. Night after night of going out in front of crowds who don't necessarily, who have come out to watch, who've taken a chance. And it's their one night out in the month or one night out in the week, and they come out to watch comedy. They've not come out to watch this. I found it.
It's interesting. If I think of people who are trying to convert, I think of Rob Newman or Mark Thomas, you know, doing political or sort of environmental work that is about trying to actually change people's minds. And although they're successful, they're not rich and famous.
Yeah, they're not commercially
successful. Yeah. So obviously there's the element of entertainment, wanting to have a happy life. Is there an element to you of your ambition?
Mm.
Like that would be a different career path for you, right?
I do want to be.
Do you know what? I'm gonna change people's hearts and minds. That's a different career path.
Yeah, yeah, and that's.
You're not getting on the Apollo with that.
I've done a TEDx talk. I've done other things, but. And stand up, I want to be commercially successful. And then if/when I get opportunities to do other things, I will do them as well. But I don't feel like I need to go and do stand up in Cornwall.
It took me a minute just to hear that word in Cornwall. I've got nothing against Cornwall.
Same. I will go on holiday there one day. But it's just, yeah, I want to go to big urban cities and towns where I know I'll have a good time. And if and when I get to the point where I'm commercially successful enough that I can draw a crowd of people that want to come and watch me because they know who I am, then I'll go to these places. But I don't want to go there and almost impose myself on people who want to watch a night of comedy because they're taking a chance on some bloke who's got some good credits.
Are you happy?
Yeah, man, I think so. I suggest I'm not. But no, I am. There's always an element of, oh, I wish this, I wish that. Oh, why has this person got that? Why has that person got that? But I think about my trajectory over the last 3 or 4 years and, yeah.
And is your happiness work-oriented? Like, you are ambitious, and I'm often interested in the root of ambition. Like, will there be enough ever?
Oh, yeah, sorry. No. I've had this conversation with friends that I think the most underrated thing in the world is contentment. And I would love to be content. God, that would be... Because you've won, right? If you're content, you've won. Whatever that means to you, whether it's just because you've got a roof over your head, or whether because you've achieved something in work or whatever, if you're content, you've won. And I don't think I'll ever be content. I haven't been so far. If I do, that's the aim, is to be content. I don't know if it's who I am.
God, that's a death sentence, isn't it?
I know.
Can you imagine a world in which you're content? Like, would it need an amount of career success to make you content, or would it need a shift in the way you see happiness? Like,
I think the latter, because with the first, I'm chasing the dragon a bit, because I might get Land of the Apollo, but I want that Netflix special. I might get the Netflix special, but I need another one now. I might get a second one. Oh, but now I want a sitcom. Got a sitcom. Well, what about, where's my US break? There's always something. I mean, why is Michael McIntyre still working? There's always something. So I don't feel work, I don't think will give me that.
So
I think what I might find it in is love or religion. My religion. And family, I think those, and the first one and the third one are linked, I guess. I think that's where I'd find it.
And how does your religion affect or inspire your creativity?
Well, I talk about being Muslim. I think it's more the political aspect of being religious is what I focus my work on,
mm-hmm.
rather than the orthodoxy of it. Rather than what it is, it's about more about what it means to be Muslim, rather than this is what Islam is. But it does hold me back in certain things. I'm not that crude. I know there was a little bit in yesterday's show about the shaving my bits and stuff, but
which is the first I'd ever heard of that.
Yeah, it's a thing. But that's also a place of, actually, I'm also telling someone about my religion, which is a thing that people don't know about. It's an obscure thing that people think has come from porn. It's like, no, we've been doing this. We've been manscaping and femscaping for about 1,400 years now. But yeah, so I try not to be very blue. I try and curb that as much as possible. And I try and talk about things that I care about.
I meant, that's a good answer, but I meant specifically in terms of your faith and the ways in which it... I had this conversation a little bit with Ola, whereby my take on faith is, I'd love to be religious. It just seems like great software. Do you know what I mean? Seems like a recipe for a happy life. I just don't believe. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I'm often envious of people who have a faith, because it just seems like a better way to live your life.
It's Richard Dawkins there.
All the Terry Pratchett. Yeah. There's a certain amount of fiction. Yes,
it's
fiction.
It's fiction, yeah. but I have the opposite. I can't not believe. Like, I look at the world and I think, and I look at the universe, and you know, I did biochemistry at university. That was my bachelor's, and I can't see. The world doesn't make sense to me without there having been God, or if not the God that I believe in, then something, some overarching supreme thing that oversaw it all. It doesn't make sense to me.
There's a certain amount of wriggle room in that, though, isn't there? Like, if not the God I believe in.
Well, no, it's just I'm just being like I you know, I believe, but also my religion teaches you to be to question and. To be intellectually driven, which is we are really bad PR in the 21st century, but yeah, it just that's just me being generous to other people's views.
Sure. So you are confident that your one is the right one.
Yeah, but also it's faith. Like, but I also know I don't have proof. I don't have what Richard Dawkins needs to believe or. You know what I find really fascinating? Do you ever watch Russell Brand's conversations? They often go viral on Facebook and stuff. Like, he has this fascinating conversation. Because I don't think he believes in, like, the Abrahamic God, but he's very spiritual. I think he believes in higher power.
I've seen him.
And he has these fascinating conversations with people like Professor Brian Cox and other people. And Brian he put this thing to Brian Cox saying, you know, talk to him about, he didn't say in these words, but he talked to him about atheism. And Brian Cox was like, I would never describe myself as atheist. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Is the question, and the truth is, I don't know, but I believe. That's why they call it faith. And it is a source of strength, and in particularly when I look at my family, and they're a lot more religiously conservative than I am. And to me, they look, at least from the outside, they look more content than I am. And that's it's really, really nice to look at. And having moved back to Blackburn last year, it's really, really nice to be part of that again. Or at least see it close up.
What's happening next year?
I'm working on a sitcom for Channel 4, which I referenced last night.
You did? You had enough currency that didn't come off as smug. You're all right. You stayed within the bounds.
I think I initially bought them up because I was annoyed about the Channel 4 Muslim documentary that was on.
Yes,
Monday. That was the initial reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Reason I brought them up. which I was in 2 months to do before going on, but I was like, you know what, fuck it.
They'll respect that.
Yeah. And that's not a guarantee. It's a thing we work on. You know, when you work on things, it's still far away from anything.
But that would be your own project.
Yes. That's me writing a thing for them. Doing Mock the Week again, which would be nice. And a couple of other things that you know how is when you're a comedian, you work on things that might not go anywhere that you can't talk about, so you have to just be a bit vexing and working on things. No Edinburgh this summer.
No Edinburgh.
No, I've been 3 in a row, and I feel like I need time off, because I feel like I look at last year's Testify, the show, and I think it's good now. Like, I'm happy with the show is what it needs to be now, but I didn't quite have it ready for Edinburgh, and that's because I didn't have enough time.
Yes. No Edinburgh this year, but writing towards Edinburgh 2015.
Yes. So I'm doing Camden Fringe this summer.
Okay.
I've booked 3 dates there, and hopefully the end of that will give me a foundation from which to build on for next year.
Yes. Christ, take a year off Edinburgh. You've still got to do Edinburgh.
I mean, I was sharing dressing with James Acaster, who's on straight after me at the Soho Theatre this week, and he's just dropped 4 Netflix specials this week, and he's doing a work in progress show. So inspiring, mm-hmm. and frustrating, but it's just, yeah, it's mad. So I feel like, you know, his work ethic is, I mean, he's one of my favorite comics, but also his work ethic is a real inspiration.
Yeah, he's definitely up there with the you make me want to work harder and give up,
yes.
kind of crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Bamford as well, Maria Bamford.
People have been raving about the show, but I think I'm going to try and catch her Netflix special. I think I made a promise to myself. One of my resolutions this year was to watch a comedian's Netflix special a month, one a month.
Yep.
But then I watched 2 in January, both of Chappelle's.
that doesn't count. You're not broadening your horizons.
Yeah, that was one. I watched Chelsea Peretti.
Yes.
It's very, very funny.
Is that one of the greats?
Yes.
It's simply one of the best pieces of branding I've ever heard of.
And
calling your special one of the greats.
And
a legitimate joke.
Yeah,
and also now your Google search is one of the greats. It's amazing.
I love her in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yes. I think she's my single favorite character in that, which is in a show that I love. So I did really enjoy that. And then I watched Chris Rock special because, you know, Godfather. And I really enjoyed it. And just watching and just seeing Bo Burnham's name in the credits was astonishing.
Yes.
What a guy. What a cool guy. He's 28?
And a fascinating move on the part of Rock to get Bo to direct his show. It was really fun seeing the different versions of you bubble out of that show. And it's really fun talking to you now and hearing you go, I'm a bit smug. I don't have you pegged as smug at all, but you are so confident that part of that confidence, I suppose, is an awareness that confidence can be misconstrued.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm also so insecure, which I'm not afraid to say. Like, I'm so scared of failing. I'm so scared that no one's going to come to watch the show. I'm scared that this is the show when all these important people are in and it's not going to go well. I have all of that.
And yet it doesn't turn into nerves before the show.
No. I think I've just eight years of doing it and just going, well, you know the show. You're going to deliver the show how you deliver it. That's not going to change. So then how they feel is slightly out of your control.
So let's talk then finally about the long dark nights of the soul, the insecurity about it. What is the What is one of the lows, and how did you get out of it?
You know what? Not missing out on that nom for best newcomer was, it felt like a real low. Like, I cried that day. I met another, I'm not going to say the person's name, but I met another comic, fantastic comic, who missed out on best show that year, who'd had rave reviews and, you know, just posted, was littered with stars. And we were sharing a dressing room because they were playing the venue next door to mine, or the room next door to mine. And we kind of just saw each other and just hugged each other and just, we both shed a little tear. And I just felt at that moment like everything I'd done was because they came to my show right up until the last moment, and then they, for whatever reason, they said no, not Tez, and these are the seven people, and it just felt like I'd let myself down, like I'd let my people had come. So I was so looking forward, like I was, you know, like you think ahead about things that you haven't got, and I was looking forward to making the phone call to my mum and saying, oh my god, I've got this thing, and I know you don't fully understand it because you're not from this world, but it's such a big deal, and Freddie Flintoff was presenting the award that year, and he went to school literally half a mile from where I live. So in my head, it
the
was
stars
like
stars had aligned. In my perfect timing with this guy.
Of course, it's Freddie Flintoff this year because this is the year of the album, you know, and all these things had aligned, and just felt like a real gut punch. And then I remember I went on stage that night, that evening. I went back on stage and I had such a fun show. And then I just realised that's what matters, is how much the audience are enjoying what I've been doing, and actually this is what matters, not the other thing. And of course, and I know I still talk about it now because it's still in the deep dark of my mind, it's still there, and it probably will be forever. But yeah, just performing that night and having, I think if I'd had a horrible show that night, I don't know what would have happened, but it was, I had such a fun show that day. Like, I had just this really wacky crowd in, and this guy hit on me. This woman, I had this bit up where I had the word "packy" on a PowerPoint slide, and this woman just went, "Hand up," and went, "You're right." And she went, "Oh, that's not how you spell packy." And I went, "What? What?" And she went, "No, it's P-A-C-K-I, isn't it?" And I went, no, it's not. And she went, no, it is. And I went, what are you doing? Like, come on, did you just want to say packy? Is that what this conversation is? Like, it was such a mad audience that night, and it was so, just took, like, in that hour, it just completely took me out of this thing that had happened to me 2 hours earlier. And I just had so much fun. And that's what I remember, that I love performing. More than, sure, the accolades are nice and I'd like to make money, I'd like to buy my farmhouse in Lancashire and all those things, but I love performing. I've never been as good at anything as I am at that, being on stage and having fun. And I do have fun because I talk about things I want to talk about in a way that I want to talk about.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, man. Thank you for having me.
So that was Tez. Get yourself along to his show at the South Bank Centre on May the 7th. Check out his stuff online. I know you're going to be a fan of his. And it's so fascinating to hear someone so successful still struggle with the bloody nomination issue. I mean, not the wider issue that we talked about. And I'm sure that will become a thing that people talk about now. I'm very grateful to Tez for risking that by talking about it. But also just that idea of how desperate people are to be nominated for a thing, even when they're arguably moving past the point at which it's necessary. It reminds me of Louisa O'Mulan, that episode from a couple of years ago, where she was doing her own incredible sellout tours and frustrated that she wasn't being booked for a 20-minute commercial club on a Friday night. So really interesting to hear people's take on that, and I'm very grateful to Tez for opening up. So I hope you check out his work. I will say a quick thank you now to Nathan Wood for editing the show, for Tez to coming on the show, and for you to listening to it, supporting it, and sharing it about the place. And now there's going to be quite an interesting postamble where I launch a thing. So if you would like to bend your ears towards that, then please do. But technically, that concludes the podcast. Okay, you still with me? I know not all of you are with me at this point, because I've seen some interesting new analytics and I know that people drop off at the end. That's completely fine. If anything, I slightly prefer it because you're the hardcore. So let me tell you about membership. You will have noticed over the last couple of weeks, and if you're supporting via Patreon or if you're in the Facebook group, I've been trying to ask around thinking, what I think I even mentioned this on the podcast, what can I do to help you? I want to try to get a sense of what other things I can do. This is very post-South by Southwest. What other things I can do to somehow add value to your life? So I've been asking around, I've been collating people's suggestions, and I feel like two of the things that people would like to get out of me, I don't know quite how to phrase that, two of the ways I can be useful. Lots of people want me to mentor them or offer feedback on their comedy shows somehow, far more than I could reasonably do. And people also just want to hang out and get to know me a bit outside of the show. Those are two things that come up often. And there's some other interesting things as well. Now, the way in which I'm going to try to move towards some of those things is by creating, as I now have done, and I've been practicing and playing with it for a little bit, and a few people are subscribed to it, there is now a private podcast feed, a separate, secret RSS feed, a podcast feed, if you're less nerdy and technical, even than me, somehow. And that now exists and is available to members. So if you would like to become a member of this podcast, it's a bit like Jimmy Pardo's Players Club or any one of a number of versions of that. Basically, you can sign up for a recurring donation, as ever, via Patreon, PayPal or Moonclerk. And from launch, which will be by the time you hear this, you get to sign up to this private podcast feed, and the sorts of things that are on it are things like all of the extra material from every show. So if you ever wanted that stuff but you couldn't get round to the, I admit, fiddly email mailing list unlocking secret code system, whatever, all of that stuff is now on the Patreon. We're doing a thing called You Interview Stu, where every, I don't know, probably not more than every month, some of you, a member, can apply to talk to me. And we have an interesting Skype interview whereby you just get to ask me what you want. And then we both record it at each end. And then we put it out on the private podcast feed so other members get to hear it and enjoy it. And maybe it'll inspire them to ask me other things. And maybe that can help be part of a creative process. Like if you want to ask me my views on marketing your Edinburgh show, that's fine. If you want to ask me my views on networking or board games or skydiving, which I've never done. My point is, anything you want, we can have a bit of a chat about, and then we release that to the podcast feed. We're doing a thing called Comedy Critique. There's got to be a better name for it than that, whereby someone sends in, a new act sends in 5 minutes of their show on video. I rip the audio, I put that on the podcast feed. We spend a week or two listening to it and then offering, there's a link in the show notes on that one to a particular app, like a workspace online, which you join and then you can give feedback to that person. And I will then repeat the audio for it the following week and you'll get to hear the person's act and then hear mine and some curated bits of all of your, the other members' feedback. So basically, I'm trying to just put a lot of stuff out there that really benefits people who are as obsessed about this show and its obsessions as I am, and I know some of you are as well. So that's now a reality. Basically, we've got this private podcast feed, and that is available to members. Now there are tiered payments: £2, £5, £10 a month. But you don't get anything different based on the tiers. Now this flies in the face of all the theory on it. People say that I should be making sure that people who pay a tenner get way more stuff, but I don't like the idea of penalising people who can't afford it. So again, like the original system, you just donate what you think's appropriate from those options, and you get the same stuff as everyone else. So it contains an element of the people who can afford it support the people who can't. But that's it. That's where I am now. This is the soft launch, because not everyone downloads this and listens to it the day it comes out. I have been gradually rolling it out to people who are already recurring payment people and members, as they are now called. We've got to think of something to bloody call it as well. I can't keep saying members. It's awful. But you can suggest that if you like. And if you are someone who is already a member but doesn't yet know it, if I've not already been in touch, I will be within the next week as I continue to roll it out to everybody. So that's that. If you want your extras from Tez, join the private podcast feed. If you want the extras from all the other episodes or this, the opportunity to interview me or to connect with other super hardcore obsessive fans of the show and talk about other people's acts and sort of what I'm hoping that becomes is a sort of a like an unreview, like a genuine piece of constructive criticism from a small community of people. I'm really excited about this. I think it could be a lot of work. Anyway, a lot of work. That's Freudian. I think it could be a lot of fun. Brackets, I'm terrified it'll be a lot of work. But I think we can do this in a really fun way. So there we go. If you want to be a member, any kind of recurring donation via comedianscomedian.com/donate. It'll eventually be /members, but I haven't got round to that yet. It's very much a soft launch. Thank you to everyone for listening. Apologies if you were at a recent headline gig that I did on a mixed bill in Tunbridge, where the audience were barking mad. It was the first sunny day of the year. They'd all been drinking all day, and everyone kept chipping in to the extent that momentum was impossible. But two people got in touch after the show. Hello, Clive, and hello, Dan, to say how much they'd enjoyed it. Regardless, I think probably they enjoyed me just struggling against the conditions. But that was very enjoyable. I was going to spend more time talking about that and the situation there, but that's enough waffle from me. Lots of people won't know about this yet because they didn't listen to the postamble. Fools! So you're the vanguard. So get stuck in. There we go. That's all for now. Speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.